Time now for our video pick of the week. Here with me is our multimedia editor, Flora Lichtman. Hi, Flora. What do you got for us this week?
Hi, Ira. This week, the flight fiesta continues for our video pick, but we are looking at flapping flight in
flapping
our video.
Flapping flight.
Yeah, like wing flight, winged flight that moves, wings that move, I guess. We went to NYU to check out a cool experiment that involves these beautiful little paper aircrafts, which are giving researchers insight into how flapping flight works. But I think we should bring on one of the designers of this experiment. Stephen Childress is a professor emeritus in the math department at New York University, and he's here with us in our New York studio. Welcome to the program.
Very nice to be with you.
So are there mysteries to be solved when it comes to how wings work?
Flapping flight is particularly interesting because the insects and the birds have learned how to use their wings in so many different ways. And the one thinks of an airplane with its fixed wings just sailing through the air and developing lift. Birds, when they flap, they use their wings to do all kinds of things, to maneuver, to develop lift, to hover. And the mechanisms and the ways in which they have devised are extremely interesting and varied. In fact, there are methods of generating lift that were first observed in insects. Men did not discover
that,
them.
That people didn't know about.
Exactly.
So let's talk about this experiment that we saw that you can see in this video on our website at Science Friday. The little things that are flying in this video don't look much like insects to me.
No, we're not trying to imitate insects. We're trying to get at the mechanics of lift generation and hovering. And so we're developing various kinds of little objects that show us something about how flapping wings are developing their lift.
And describe the experimental setup, because I was amazed at the supplies you use.
It's very it's a very simple experiment to construct. In fact, I did a little mock-up at home with just things around the house to get going so I can describe it the way I first put it together. I took a tube and I took a loudspeaker and I put the loudspeaker at the bottom of the tube and turned it on, and so the air in the column begins to oscillate, and you could feel it as the speaker
playing.
Goes up and down. I mean, the speaker is driving some air up and down. Uh-huh. Every speaker does, and so then I wanted to put things in and watch them fly and look like insects, but I was a little concerned. I thought the speaker would make the wings flap, and therefore I would have to push some air up to cause them to lift up. So I had a little one of these little home vacuum cleaners, these little dust busters around the house. I attached that to the bottom to blow some air up. And I turned it on, and I made a few little insects out of balsa and tissue paper. And I put them in there, and darn, they just sort of moved up and began to flap their little wings and looked around and began to fly. So I was very taken with this. I took it into our lab to show the guys, and we began to play with it. And then something happened. I was sitting there with it, watching these things fly, and I turned off the speaker so that there was no vibration, and everything just fell to the ground. So we saw that it was the oscillating air which was driving the lift primarily, not the air pushing up.
Not the dust buster.
Not the dust buster. And so we decided that we could do this with purely oscillating air. We built a much bigger model of this, and that's the one you saw and the one we photographed. And it began an experimental program in which we observe these little things flying. And we built all kinds of things to put in there, as you saw.
And it's basically taking the flap of a wing and taking it out of the wings and putting it into the air, right?
Exactly right, Flora. In a sense, we're saying, let's move the air past the wings instead of the wings through the air. It's very hard to train an insect to hover there to hover there for you. And it's very hard to build these things, too, that flap their wings. It's something we're trying to do, but it's very hard to get something.
One thing that amazed me is how stable these little, I mean, they look like little sort of origami figures. You know, there's a pyramid, and one looks sort of like a donut or a UFO, cup-shaped, all of them. But they stay in the air pretty well.
This is what is driving our work, primarily. One of the problems with hovering flight, at least man-made hovering flight, is stability. And in particular for flapping flight, it's not clear how to achieve stability without significant feedback controls and so on. And of course, insects have this. What we found with our little paper bugs is that there is a there's an extreme stability to large excursions from the way they would like to hover. So there's something that keeps them from going too far. And within this sort of envelope, they can maneuver around very nicely. But this stability is what is interesting, most interesting, really, for this particular type of experiment.
Did you find out what it is that keeps them from tipping over?
We have done those experiments, and yes, we think we understand the basic mechanism. This gets a little technical in the sense that wings, when you move them to the air, it's something we don't see very easily, but we all know about eddies, and they're little vertical eddies that are shed by the tips of the wings when they move through the air. And these little whirlpools are then ejected by the wings. And it's this ejection of little whirlpools that generates the lift. And these things are changing in such a way that gives this stability.
You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Flora Lichtman, and I'm sitting next to the host, Ira Flatow, and Stephen Childress from NYU. So you were talking about these vortices, which I think I've seen on the back of when I'm paddling a canoe, right?
Yes, exactly.
Same kind of thing.
Exactly.
And they actually shoot out and will correct if something is tipping over. They'll shoot in the direction that pushes them so the object doesn't tip. Is that the kind of...
That's correct. As the object tilts, the direction the vortices are ejected changes in such a way that gives the stability. That's what we seem to observe. By the way, we did this with very simple experiments involving a water tank, which is sloshing back and forth. You could and looking at a shadow graph of the vortices.
So. Is that what gives it lift also?
It gives it lift also, yes.
That
exactly.
Explains the hovering flapping then, how they can stay there.
Exactly.
I wondered with the hovering, I mean, does that mean that when an insect is hovering, it's sort of generating these vortices just enough to counteract gravity? That sounds like complicated physics to me, or beyond my...
Well, they know they want to hover, so I guess they just adjust themselves to and they have significant control mechanisms to tell them exactly when they are positioned and not turning and so on.
We only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to know, how did you get into flight?
I've had a love affair with airplanes. I guess in my generation, we built model airplanes. Now we build computers, but I built model airplanes, and then I got my pilot's license and so on and went down that road and have worked in the industry a little bit. So
you've done this in and out of the lab then?
Yes.
And you're an emeritus professor, which means... You're just doing it for the love of the...
Exactly, at this point.
They don't pay anymore.
They don't pay me
a thing. You're still in love with this.
Exactly.
And I'm going to give you this. I'm going to give you these blank check question because you're working with a soup pot. And if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, you'll see this.
From Chinatown.
This is a soup pot with a hole cut out in it and a tube stuck on the top of it on a speaker.
A subwoofer from Canal Street.
So. I spent many months down there before the World Trade Center was there. So let's not go there right now. But so it's forcing air up and you're throwing paper objects in that are fluttering up and down. If you could do it with a blank check, what would you make? How much you spend any amount of money? How would you change it?
Well, I would probably. We want to build a flapper that actually does move its wings in the air and uses this kind of principle, and it's going to be perhaps a fairly expensive project. But we want to build this object and perhaps try to build it in different sizes to see the effective size, because after all, insects are not huge.
Right. But if we could flap our wings at that speed, we could actually go up and down with those vortices too.
Well, I wouldn't say at our size.
At our size.
We're a little tinier, maybe.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Our video pick of the week, it's up there at sciencefriday.com. You can see these cute little things flying around in the tube. You can make one. You can do this one at home. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Steve Childress is a professor emeritus in New York's math department. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help from NPR librarian Kima Leski. If you missed any part of our program, go over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can see Flora's video pick of the week. Make a project for yourself this holiday season. And also go to our website and take us along as an iPhone and Android app and continue a discussion all week long on SciFry. Have a great holiday weekend. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Be safe. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Popular Science magazine is out with its 100 Best Innovations issue. If you've got hard-to-please family members on your holiday shopping list, maybe you want to consider something like an inflatable wetsuit for big wave surfing. That's just one of the year's top gadgets. Tell us a little more about some of the noteworthy innovations. We have Mark Janot in our New York studios. He's the editor-in-chief of Popular Science. Thanks for being with us.
It's always fun, Scott.
And tell us about this year's Grand Award winner. I'm actually getting excited about this.
Yes, absolutely. Every year we give one of our top 100 the distinction of being the Innovation of the Year. And this year that glorious honor goes to the Litro Lightfield camera. This camera has the potential to revolutionize yet again that thing that so many of us do all the time, which is take pictures. Mm-hmm. It actually kind of reverses the sequence of taking a picture. You don't have to worry about focusing until after you take the shot. The Litro has an array of micro lenses in between its primary lens and its sensor that splits mm-hmm. the light into thousands of different paths and basically creates thousands of different images so that when you open up that image in its software, you can determine where you want the focus to be, anywhere on the picture.
And what made you folks decide that it deserved the number one slot?
Well, when we look for innovation of the year, we tend to be weighing it between devices that are going to be truly great consumer devices that can mm-hmm. have a broad impact on our day-to-day gadget use. Often, they get weighed against life-saving devices of medical sorts. And that was more or less the case this year. I think we may be talking about the diagnostics on a chip, which was a really strong contender. It kind of came down to the wire. It was sort of a toss-up this year.
Well, let me get you to talk about diagnostics on a chip, too.
Yeah, the situation that this is correcting for is the fact that a quarter of the 13 million patients worldwide who are undergoing treatment for HIV or tuberculosis won't die from their diseases, but from complications, liver complications, caused by the treatment itself. And those are all preventable, but they require regular screening that until now has required expensive lab work that uses microscopes and computer chips and that sort of thing, particularly difficult in the developing world, obviously. Mm-hmm. And this is Diagnostics for All is the company that has created a lab on a chip that is basically a printed piece of paper with diagnostic assay agents coating it. They cut it up into postage stamp-sized chips, basically, and you drop a little blood sample on it, and within a few minutes, 15 minutes, it changes color to indicate various states of liver health. It's very easy to read, and it costs not hundreds of dollars, but 5 cents.
The implications for that are extraordinary.
Yes.
Let's get to home entertainment. 3D viewing goggles. That took one of the top honors.
Indeed. In home entertainment, this was the Grand Award winner. It's from Sony, their HMZ T1 personal 3D viewer. This is sort of a visor that goes over your eyes. It takes sort of the loneliness of the home 3D viewing to an all-new level, basically. You shut yourself off from everyone around you, but the experience is extraordinary. You look like Geordi LaForge on Star Trek with this visor over your eyes, mm-hmm. but it actually gives you the experience that's equivalent to sitting 65 feet from a 62.5-foot movie screen.
Now, this 3D device costs $800, right?
Indeed, and the reality of our Best of What's New awards, because we are constantly at sort of the cutting edge of consumer technology, is that the price points tend to be sort of as awe-inspiring as the gadgets, but in our current age of rapidly accelerating processor power and miniaturization mm-hmm. and things like that, the price does tend to come down fairly quickly.
Anything else you'd like to point us to?
Well, one of my favorite things is something called the Cryomation Cryomator. This is a way to avoid having your carbon footprint outlast you into death, basically. when a person dies, either they're buried, which uses up valuable arable land, or they're cremated, which releases the body's carbon into the atmosphere. The cryomator is a machine that actually chills the body with liquid nitrogen until it breaks apart and then freeze-dries the remains to remove water and kill microbes. And the powder that results actually keeps the body's carbon in it. So you're actually not releasing carbon into the air. It actually the entire carbon impact of the process is about 75% less than it is on cremation.
Environmentally correct into the afterlife.
Indeed.
Mark Cheneaux, editor-in-chief of Popular Science magazine. Mark, thanks so much.
Sure. It's been a pleasure, Scott.
Gadgets like cell phone cameras and digital tablets can turn almost anybody into some kind of amateur journalist. But writer Gwen Tompkins wonders when the amateurs will realize that what the professionals already know. Recording an event often stops people from experiencing what's right in front of them.
Forget the fancy theologians and philosophers. Musician Dr. John says it best. Life is made up of the spirit world and the meat world. We humans are just passing through. This week, both worlds were in full focus on Frenchman Street in New Orleans, just outside the French Quarter. We had gathered there to honor an artist. Coco Robichaud, that swaggering and otherworldly blues musician, had crossed some days before to full-time status among the spirits. Robichaud died at the age of 64, collapsing at a club on this very street. As the parade came together, most of us were taking photographs, or collecting video, or recording sound, including Daryl Young, the guy everybody here knows as Dancing Man 504.
Coco, everybody here today is here to send you to the gates of heaven, letting them know that not only were you loved in life, you are loved in the afterlife. Yeah!
In our defense, the street scene was as phantasmic as a Fellini film. Four grand marshals, brass bands, aging courtesans, a toothless hobo, cabaret performers, a dead ringer for Teddy Roosevelt, babies, incense, reefers, whiskey, a television star, and a man wearing a onesie and a dog leash, led by a ponytailed impresario. But all of our digital recording made it hard for the second line to move forward. Robichaud's friends admonished us to focus on Coco. That's Sonali Fernando singing over everybody else. She's a music promoter, but all she was carrying that day was a cigarette. Fernando wasn't just on Frenchman Street, she was in the moment, halfway between the meat world and the spirit world. I envied her. For a second, I remembered a time years ago when, as a young newspaper reporter, I was trampled by paparazzi. We were in France, and we were clamoring for a shot of then-President Clinton walking on a beach at Normandy. I missed seeing the president, so I limped back to see some of the graves of the soldiers who died in the Allied invasion. For a brief spell, I didn't worry about deadline. I was in the moment, and the graves and the wildflowers are what I remember best about Normandy, which is probably a good thing. Nobody got trampled in the second line for Coco Robichaud, but I wondered how many of us were actually, and yes, I mean this in the metaphysical sense, there. By the middle of this song, I was dancing. I wanted to be part of what was happening in my headphones. As the sun set, the second line moved away, and fog settled over the neighborhood. One of Coco Robichaud's many admirers, now tired and a little drunk, walked away smiling. Suddenly, she boasted to no one in particular, "We said goodbye real pretty, don't you think?"
When I die, burn my body, don't you dare put it in the ground. Throw my ashes on the water. Let the Mississippi River take me down.
That's Coco Robichaud singing Burn My Bones. The equally fabulous Gwen Tompkins is a writer in New Orleans. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Army Private Bradley Manning turns 24 years old today. Hundreds of his supporters say they'll rally outside Fort Meade, Maryland, where a military officer is hearing evidence that Private Manning leaked hundreds of thousands of war logs and diplomatic cables to the website WikiLeaks. If investigators recommend Manning face court-martial, it could land him in prison for the rest of his life. NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson spent some time in the courtroom and brings us this report.
At a shade over 5 feet tall in black framed army glasses and a green camouflage uniform, Bradley Manning may have been the least imposing person in the courtroom at Fort Meade. And yet, four military prosecutors are starting to present evidence that the young army private is to blame for one of the biggest leaks in recent history. They say Manning, disillusioned by his service, downloaded troves of secret documents from a computer station in Baghdad and passed them to WikiLeaks. Most of the court action so far has focused less on Bradley Manning and more on the process itself. Manning's hard-nosed civilian lawyer, David Coombs, challenged the impartiality of the Army lawyer leading the hearing. Coombs said because the investigator, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Almanza, worked at the Justice Department in his civilian life, he just couldn't be fair to Manning. He added that the Justice Department has poured lots of resources into trying to build a criminal case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. In fact, Coombs argued the Justice Department still might take over from the Army in prosecuting Manning's case. But Almanza, with support from the military prosecutors, refused to step aside. He says his work at the Justice Department has nothing to do with classified information or national security. What really seemed to be bothering Manning's lawyer was a series of rulings by the hearing officer. Almanza has denied the defense access to secret government reports that focused on whether the leak had done any harm. Coombs looked back to a few dozen people sitting in the courtroom and cried out, "This case rises and falls on whether or not information is classified and whether its release caused harm." But Almanza, the hearing officer, pointedly interrupted to ask who the defense lawyer was addressing. Point being, his target audience clearly wasn't the man who will decide if Bradley Manning will face court-martial. The hearing continued in stops and starts with long breaks while one side or another wrote up court papers or considered legal issues. And if that pace continues, the proceeding could run right up until Christmas. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
NPR News.
Sites like Twitter intertwine our social lives, and new websites make it easier to share not just thoughts and photos, but what we're listening to or reading or even exactly what's on our plates. Sri Srinivasan is a digital media professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. We asked him to share his favorite new social networking tools with us.
One of the tools is something called Spotify, S-P-O-T-I-F-Y, and what it allows you to do is to listen to thousands and thousands of songs, but as you listen to them, you're also telling your friends what you're listening to at that moment so that they'll be encouraged to tune in and listen to those songs as well.
So how does the Spotify sharing actually happen? How do they find out what you're listening to?
You're, as part of what the life of a digital user today is, that you might be sharing even when you're not aware of it. But with Spotify, you're sharing within Facebook, and that then is kind of fun for your family and friends to hear what they're listening to, what you're listening to, and maybe they will add that to their playlist. But then again, it also says something about you that you may not want said. People start making judgments on your taste and jumping to all these conclusions that you may not want them to. I listen to, on occasion, I'll confess, Dancing Queen by ABBA, and I don't want everyone to know that I'm listening to it at that moment.
Now, what about this business of sort of a niche way to use social media sites, specific niche sharing sites?
Right. People are sharing all kinds of things in very specific ways. There's a service called Instagram, which allows you to share just the pictures you're taking, but to share it within a photography community. There is a service called Food Spotting, which allows you to share what dishes you're eating at a specific restaurant so that people can know what dishes to pick. Now, the background of all of this is that you could do any of this stuff on Facebook, but then you're doing that with a much larger community, and your photos get mixed in with your recipes, which get mixed in with your complaints about your boss. In these niche networks, they're specifically for those topic areas, and people are spending a lot of time there.
Is Facebook on its way out because of all this new competition?
Well, there's been some softening of the numbers in the U.S., but it still remains the big, powerful way in which people are sharing and communicating online. This year, Google introduced Google Plus, which went directly after Facebook by saying part of the problem on Facebook is whatever you shared with everybody. So Google Plus allowed you to share with specific cohorts. Now, Facebook this fall has done what I call the Empire Strikes Back, because it has come back strong against Google Plus by allowing you to share in specific groups. And they've also gone after Twitter in the sense that they now allow you to connect with people who want to be connected to, but who may not be your friends directly.
One of the changes they made was to introduce something called Timeline. And Timeline appears to me to reduce whatever shreds were left of privacy by permitting people to, to go back and look at something you might have put on your Facebook account when you were a mere child and didn't know any better.
Right. Before it was introduced, there was the sense of what we call security by obscurity. That is, you have stuff on Facebook, but there's so much stuff there, nobody will find it. Well, now comes Timeline, and instantly I can go back to 2007 and see pictures you may not be proud of just sitting there and easily surfaced.
Well, Mr. Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, I have to ask, what was he thinking when he did this?
Well, this is what Mr. Zuckerberg is always thinking, is how to get people to share information, to be more connected to each other. But the other thing is, clearly, the more information they have about you, the more they can sell your information to marketers, the more useful you will be for advertisers. And that's part of this process. And there is no doubt in my mind that people will react in different ways to the timeline. But as with many things at Facebook, they'll get used to it, and we will continue to overshare with our friends, our family, and with marketers.
Sri Srinivasan, thank you very much for this.
My pleasure.
Sri Srinivasan is a digital media professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism. You can follow him on Twitter at Sri, that's spelled S-R-E-E. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lynn Nearing.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. In Wired Magazine's App Guide, we read that the phenomenal proliferation of apps for your smartphone is something understandable. A Wired contributor writes that at the start of a war for control of a new platform, quantity typically trumps quality. As of a couple of months ago, the Apple Store was offering 425,000 apps. The Android market was estimated to be a mere 250,000. The Wired App Guide itself is a measure of that wartime abundance. The magazine reviews no less than 400 apps. And here to talk about that effort is John Bradley. He is a senior editor at Wired and editor of the App Guide. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
According to Wired's note from the editor, your experts will brave the App Store so that we don't have to.
Yes. App Store experience is not always a pleasant one, for sure. It can be a little bit overwhelming.
Have your experts actually taken a few hundred thousand apps for a test drive?
No, nowhere near that much. And gosh, I hope that nobody's had to do that. we always go back to the cereal aisle is sort of an example of capitalism gone awry. I think the App Store is a better example of that. It's complete anarchy in there.
The App Review lumps apps into categories. And in the health area, for one, you've observed that there's now a whole body of apps that amount to a work in progress called the quantified self.
Yeah, the quantified self is a bigger movement in kind of technology and health right now. And apps are certainly part of that. But it's just the idea that, we talk about the Internet of Things, which is all of our devices are connected and talking to each other. And through apps and various hardware devices, we can become a part of that Internet of Things, where we are measuring our, you know, our heart rate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, our sleep patterns, calories in, calories out, really quantifying what's happening with your body. And the idea there is that, you know, if you're in a tight feedback loop and getting constant feedback, you'll respond and adjust your behaviors a lot more quickly than if you're checking it once a day or once a week or, you know, once a year when you're going to the doctor.
Photography is a category for which there are a lot of apps, and I know that you're a big fan of one called Instagram. What's so good about Instagram?
You know, I think it's the best example of what mobile phones have done for photography, which is that they've really closed the gap. I mean, I think there are a lot more people in the world who have a really good eye than have good technical photographic knowledge. And with Instagram, you can just take a picture, scroll through all these different filters and apply them to the images. And even if you were starting out with kind of a lousy original image, you can create something that is artistic and interesting and compelling. And I consider it's a social app as much as a photography app.
Does it strike you as peculiar that nearly all of the 400 apps that you review in the Wired App Guide cost substantially less than the guide itself? These are things that cost 99 cents, $2.99. They're remarkably cheap.
They are. It's shocking. I mean, I think that our idea of value in this space has gotten a little skewed. I mean, I thought it was kind of entertaining seeing what happened with Netflix when they changed their pricing model and people were complaining about $8 a month for unlimited streaming. I think that we severely undervalue what these things are giving us. I'm still in awe of what I can get for 99 cents on my phone.
If you were to direct us to one great app that we've likely not heard of and is just fantastic and can do something we hadn't thought of, which one would you send me to right now?
I think one that is uniquely addictive, it's an Android app called Sleep as Android.
Sleep as Android?
Yeah, and Android is two words, A-N space droid. There's an external bit of hardware that you wear when you go to sleep, and it tracks your sleep patterns. And this goes back to what we were talking about with the quantified self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got your rhythms as you're sleeping, and there are points where it's much easier to wake up than others. And so this app tracks your sleep cycles and makes sure that your alarm goes off at a point where it's easier for you to wake up,
You're kidding.
No, it's wonderful. But, you know, it also quantifies your quality of sleep, which I found could be kind of counterproductive because you look at your data and you think, oh, man, I could have slept so much better last night. You know, I'm going to do better tonight. And then you're lying there in bed really concentrating on having a good night's sleep, and it makes it even harder to get to sleep. So there's a dark side to that app.
Well, John Bradley, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Bradley of Wired is the editor of Wired's App Guide, 400 reviews of essential tools.